Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogers is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
It's Thursday, May 24th, 2018. I'm Dan Rogers of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 392. Today on the show, the pressure high school students feel when it comes to selecting a college and a career path. Psychologist Brad Sachs, with an office in Howard County, one of the most affluent counties in the United States, recalls the suicide of a teenager who jumped to his death while clutching his admissions letter from Princeton. The young man had been accepted to the Ivy League University, a cruel irony of that tragedy. That was 10 years ago, but you can find in press reports since then several cases of students taking their own lives while in the midst of their struggles with the pressure to succeed academically and to earn acceptance to a prestigious college. In February, in affluent Newport Beach, California, a 16-year-old boy named Patty Turner left suicide notes about the pressures he felt over final exams and college expectations. Here's what Patty Turner wrote in one of the notes. "So much pressure is put on kids to do good, and a lot of kids make mistakes. One slip-up makes a kid feel like the smallest person in the world. You are looked at as a loser if you don't go to college or if you get a certain GPA or test score. There is never a moment to break. So much pressure is put on the students to do well that I couldn't do it anymore." Patty Turner's letters got into the press and sparked a national conversation about the pressures kids feel to excel and to get to top-tier colleges, even to decide a career path in their early teen years. Brad Sachs is a longtime family psychologist based in Columbia, Maryland, and he works with children and parents as they struggle through the college decision, right up until graduation season, and in some cases, beyond that.
Although many, if not most, high school seniors have made a decision, there are probably still some, even in June and July, who are holding out for a waiting list or trying to toggle back and forth between different possibilities or waiting for financial aid packages to come in. So even at this date, when decisions by the colleges have been made, a lot of families that I'm seeing, you know, through the end of the school year are still really struggling with this issue.
What's the struggle?
The struggle, I think, is based on the mythology that you have to go to a highly prestigious selective college to have a satisfying life.
And that's still a thing.
And I think it's a destructive mythology, and I think it interferes terribly with many aspects of adolescent development through high school. And it's a conversation that I think should be structured differently, because as long as we rely on this mythology, I think we're making things harder than necessary. It's important that high school students understand that there's no data that suggests there's any connection between you, where you go to school, and your eventual income or your job satisfaction or your life satisfaction. There's absolutely no connection there. So yes, while you may have that momentary feeling of pride that I went to this school, or perhaps some momentary moment of shame or embarrassment that you went to that school, in terms of life trajectory and the axes that define a meaningful life, there's no data that suggests there's any connection between where we go to college, or even if we graduate from college, and job satisfaction, life satisfaction.
But we live with this assumption and the expectation that if I went to the school my father did, I went to the most prestigious school that my mother did, I will stay in that social stratosphere. I will always be part of the elite, so to speak. I will always be guaranteed things in life. Maybe it's part of white privilege in America to expect those things.
I think it is. Economically, and of course so much of this is driven by economics, that gap between the haves and the have-nots continues to grow. And so worried parents naturally want their children on the have side rather than the have-not side. But that's where the mythology comes in, to imagine that you're a have-not if you don't attend a terribly expensive and highly selective school is really ill-advised and misguided. And of course, what we also know, just sticking with economics for a moment, is many times it becomes tremendously burdensome for young adults to enter adult life already a hostage to the past, in this case, the past of their education, and it really hobbles them in ways that might not have taken place otherwise if they had been more flexible about where they were going to school.
And they're getting this from their parents, right? I mean, because, Brad, I wonder, are the kids feeling this from their parents, or are the kids feeling this from peers?
I think there's a lot of finger pointing. You know, the parents will blame the school and say, well, the school's insisting, you know, my kid take five AP classes so that our high school looks like we send kids to good colleges. And then the high schools blame the colleges and say, I don't think it's a simple matter, but it always comes down to parents and how you have that conversation with your child about these issues. Schools can play a big role too, but ultimately it's around the dinner table where these decisions are going to be made and these priorities and values are going to be established. So I don't know who's to blame, and I'm not a social scientist, so I wouldn't be the person to ask or an economist. But I do know enough to know that parents are the ones who can have the most influence on this. And the problem is, of course, no one wants to put the gun down first. No one wants to be the parent who says, you know what, I'm not playing this game, and I'm not going to make my son or daughter a frenzied mess for the last 3 years of high school simply because it's going to look good on my bumper sticker on the back of my car.
Mm-hmm.
So parents have probably the most influence. You know, could college admissions committees do things differently? I guess. Could schools administrators do things differently? I guess. But ultimately, it comes down to the family.
One of the things I heard coming out of the last financial crisis that we had, 2007, 2008, and the years after that, when unemployment was still around 9, 10%,
yeah.
On the midday show, whenever we talked about higher education, invariably somebody would call and say, liberal arts colleges, they don't make any sense anymore. I don't want to send my kid there. My son needs to learn a technical skill. He needs to become an engineer. My daughter needs to get into science. Liberal arts education, what do you get out of that? And it's just very expensive. So there's that pressure, too, for a kid, I think, to get on track toward a vocation. I guess some people consider it a luxury to be able to go to a liberal arts college and, you know, study philosophy and Shakespeare and read Leaves of Grass, you know, over a semester. You know what I'm saying? There's a different kind of pressure there. And I started hearing that in the last 10 years.
That we want to look carefully at the sort of bang for the buck makes sense. I don't think, and there's plenty who agree with me, there's any shame in leaving high school and going into a trade. And there's clear economic evidence that in some ways that's a better way to make a living these days than going to college or graduate school than trying to find a job in a highly specialized academic field. So there's nothing wrong with that. On the flip side, I don't think there's anything wrong with a liberal arts education, and there's much that's quite important and rewarding about it.
Well, I don't either, but I think there are some people who are suspicious of it now.
Well, it depends. If you're being asked to pay $70,000 a year for a liberal arts education with a questionable outcome professionally, that's an important conversation for the family to have. And that's where I think we run aground is it's one thing to have a liberal arts education at a college that's very affordable for the family. It's another thing to have one that's going to put the whole family in debt and completely annihilate retirement savings and then perhaps leave the young adult paying backwards for the first 15 years of his or her adult life.
Do parents discuss that with their kids?
Not enough. That's what I encourage them to do. I think by 16, 17, 18, children are old enough to hear a little bit more about the economic realities entailed with going to this college, which might cost $300,000 for 4 years versus mm-hmm. that college, which might be $50,000.
So, say parents can afford that kind of a bill, a $60,000 a year liberal arts college. They may not want to have that conversation. They may feel like if they can afford it, the child should be able to do whatever they want to do without getting into the calculus of whether there's going to be a payoff for you.
Right. But then the question goes back to those more fundamental themes. What role do you see college playing in your life, and how much do you want to sacrifice on the altar of going to that college? Because the bigger problem that I see is not just whether or not they can handle it economically, but whether they can handle it psychologically. The crucible that so many high school students are in because of this misguided belief that only if they follow that very narrow, restricted path to a highly selective college is both figuratively and to some extent literally killing them. I mean, I'm brought in to consult a lot in counties where there have been suicides because, you know, a suicide has tremendous psychological repercussions. And there was one county where a terribly tragic story, a student jumped off the roof of the school, killed himself, and he was holding his Princeton admissions letter. And to me, that was just such a tragic and terribly ironic reality, which is here he had achieved that promontory, the acceptance to the Ivy League school, and look at the price he paid. He literally paid with his life.
He couldn't take the pressure?
Well, I don't know because I didn't know him, but right. One might speculate that the statement that he made is that he was spent. You know, whatever he had to do, whatever sacrifices he made, and I don't know the details, willingly, unwillingly, under duress, not, the prospect of imagining that this, you know, admissions into this highly selective institution is going to guarantee my satisfaction or happiness is highly problematic and often quite inaccurate.
That segues into something I wanted to share with you from a book I've been reading about a gifted and talented young man who committed suicide. And there was a passage here that I marked I wanted to read to Brad Sachs. Gifted children and young adults with their idealism and perfectionism are often able to hide their deepest worries from us. This is the young man's mother writing. She says, I remember from the past reading that this trait is also known as masking. The psychologist is aware of other gifted student suicides where that was the case, where the parents had no idea the child was that troubled.
Yes, yeah. And what's hard, of course, is all children mask. I mean, that's part of growing up, is deciding what you're going to share and what you're not going to share. When we went to the Anne Frank Museum, it was very touching because Otto, the father, had a very close relationship with Anne Frank. But when he went back after the war and found the diary and read it, he realized he didn't have any idea who his daughter was. And this is a father and daughter who were quite close.
Yeah.
Psychologically and geographically,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yet he read this diary and it was like the life of another young woman whom he didn't know. So children are always masking, and that's part of their developmental imperative. That's not always a bad thing. But yes, we sometimes get seduced. Well, if he's taking all of these AP classes or if she's acing these standardized tests that don't end, he or she must be doing well. You know, it's a little bit like a duck. There's, you know, serenely coasting, but under the surface, they're frantically paddling. And we miss that because we, as parents and adults, get a little bit seduced. How neat it is that my son is such a high achiever, or my daughter is so highly accomplished. And doesn't it make me feel good compared to the other parents that he or she is ascending and soaring into adulthood? But again, at what price? You know, what sacrifices are being made? And a more real, in-depth, and concrete conversation about the role that college plays, I think, would have an ameliorative impact on this and would decrease and diminish and mitigate some of that tension that builds up inexorably and is quite difficult to manage.
I come from the perspective of the solid B-plus student in high school, yeah, who was always striving and went to college, decided not to play football in college because I wanted to focus on academics because I thought, you know, you've got to achieve. I've got to do better than I did in high school,
yeah,
in this place that, you know, we're paying for. Okay. By contrast, I can think of a young person that I know who aced everything all the way through high school. It seemed to be almost a breeze.
Yeah.
And then she got a great scholarship to go to a great school and hit a wall.
Yeah.
Maybe she was spent like that young man on the roof.
Yeah.
But she just couldn't take it. She was in a gifted and talented or advanced math program in college and just couldn't take the pressure and walked away from it.
Yeah.
And it took a while to recover from that.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, like I said, I'm very busy with families now who are trying to make sense of the decision regarding what college is best. But I'm also really busy in October and November when all those students who were perhaps shoved or maneuvered into schools that they didn't really belong at all of a sudden hit the skids.
And they're away from home and freaking out.
Yeah, and they don't have that level of support and intensity and engine pushing
them
forward.
It's tough.
So, you know, we all confront our limitations at some point in life. I mean, and it's painful to confront limitations. But to thrust young adults into environments or ecologies where they're doomed to fail, or to make them miserable for the several years leading up to it so they can wind up in an environment that's a tremendous mismatch, to me, that's terribly cruel to children. And then we wonder why there's, you know, escalating diagnoses of various disorders. I don't think those things occur in a vacuum. I think a lot of that is the result of this seemingly relentless pressure to perform, when adolescence is about transforming. It's about growing, not performing, but we're so intent on the performance.
So again, from a personal perspective, I'm one of those parents that let my kids decide what they want to be in life.
Yes.
I talk to them, counsel them, ask them questions, but it's their call, right?
Right.
So I didn't get too involved in any of that. By contrast, I've had friends whose kids seem to be on track to become attorneys or biophysicists when they were 14.
Right.
You know, I think at their parents' insistence or their parents steering them this way. I'm not sure the kids were that.
Well, that's a good question.
Clued into that. You know, I wonder, gee, did I do the right thing? Yeah, maybe I should have made it a little more structured and have goal setting at the age of 14 or 15. I wasn't this way. I never got on track for anything. I just found the news business one summer,
right.
and I was lucky. I fell in love with it. And at 19, I knew what I wanted to do the rest of my life.
But I think that's how decisions are made and how life courses
happens.
Evolve. Yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
And look, I don't doubt, and in fact, I see plenty of children who know from an early age exactly what they want to do, and they kind of don't deviate from that path. And that's fine if it's literally from an interior initiative or ambition. But as you noted, it's not always clear. Sometimes, particularly during middle childhood and early adolescence, who's running the show here? Mm-hmm. Am I doing this to keep everybody else happy, or is this for me? And many adolescents have to find ways to unplug or disinvest for a period of time from everything that was expected of them to figure out, okay, who's this for? Who gets the feather in their cap? You know, is this a feather in my parents' cap, or is this a feather in my cap? Or do I even want to wear this cap? That sense of most of us really would prefer to fail living our own life than being a success living someone else's life. Because ultimately, if you're living someone else's life, it's a charade and it comes to get you.
In most cases, how does it work out? Would you say, in most of the cases you've seen where this is an issue, their parents and their children come to speak to you about it?
Well, I think ultimately, because all of us have within us a desire to be true to ourselves, and all of us really want to discover our true character, I think that runs the show. But sometimes we create impediments to that, our true nature, our child's true nature taking over. So despite a parent's effort to engineer and orchestrate and maneuver their son or daughter, most of us at some level and at a certain point harness our own internal desires and ambitions and follow that path. And that may or may not be good news for the parents, but it's awfully good news for the young adult who's moving forward.
Two movies I wanted to share with you on this that come to mind during this discussion. There was a movie from, I think, the 1950s called, or early 60s, called Fear Strikes Out. It was the Jimmy Pearsall story. Jimmy Pearsall was a talented baseball player with a hard-driving father, and the movie played by Carl Malden.
Come on, let's go now. Come on, Jim, let's go. Let's go. Hustle in there. What didn't you owe me? Turn it in now, Jim. Come on. Come on, Jim, like a big leaguer here. Big leaguer now.
Jimmy Pearsall was played by Anthony Perkins. And this father was just driving him, driving him,
right.
driving him all the time. He actually drove him into a mental hospital.
Yes.
You know, he had a big, terrible breakdown.
Yeah.
He was playing for the Red Sox.
Right.
So there's a cautionary tale there.
Yeah.
Know? Hey, Dad, don't overdo it.
Right.
Let your son decide what he wants to be in life.
Right.
And the other one was Dead Poets Society. And among the characters in that film was a young man who yearned to be a thespian, or at least enjoyed A Midsummer Night's Dream, I think, was the play that they put on it.
Yeah.
But his father was driving him toward a profession, and took no interest in this, thought it was frivolous for him to engage in this.
Yeah.
We're not going to let you ruin your life. Tomorrow I'm withdrawing you from Welton and enrolling you in Brayton Military School. You're going to Harvard, and you're going to be a doctor.
That's 10 more years. Father, that's a lifetime!
Oh, stop it! Don't be so dramatic. You make it sound like a prison term. You don't understand, Neil. You have opportunities that I never even dreamt of, and I am not going to let you waste
them. I've got to tell you what I feel!
I've been so worried about...
What? Tell me what you feel! What is it? Is it more of this acting business? Because you can forget that.
And I think you remember this ended tragically.
Yes.
Those two stories just come to mind about the hard-driving father that I guess I never was. And I don't know if I got it from those movies or what. But you got to be careful how hard you push your kids.
You do. You know. Sometimes it's truly damaging and traumatic. And I guess Fear Strikes Out might be one example of that. I didn't see the movie, but I know Jimmy Pearsall's story. Sometimes it's more of what we were just saying a moment ago. It just distracts the young adult from finding his or her true path or true calling and being able to summon from within what draws them or allowing them to discover something, as you did with journalism. As you said, that's really a lovely story and an important tale. But it's very hard for parents to trust that their children will evolve. And, of course, sometimes that evolution takes them in ways that the parent is not comfortable with, and the parents have their own history. You know, if you grew up in severe privation, the idea of a thespian son or daughter is not going to be high on your list of good vocational choices.
Right. It's also part of letting go, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let them make
their
own way.
It's all about letting go.
It is. It's about letting go. At some point, you got to follow your own bliss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Brad.
Always a pleasure, Dan.
Brad Sachs specializes in clinical work with children, adolescents, couples, and families. He is the founder and director of the Father Center, a program designed to meet the needs of new fathers. You can find Brad Sachs on the list of the books he's written on his website, and there's a link to it in the notes with today's episode. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. And if you get a chance, review our show on your Apple Podcast app or for Android users on Stitcher. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again Friday for our weekend show.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. This month, the Ivy welcomes Michael Downs to celebrate the launch of his book, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. Downs imagines the mysteries behind the true story of Horace Wells, who first used laughing gas as an anesthetic, reshaping medicine and humanity's relationship with pain. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.